This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. It's a generally accepted fact that the United States, despite the threat of terrorism, despite the shaky economy, is still very much the world's leading superpower. And that's a guiding principle of much of the Bush administration's foreign policy, its pursuit of disarming Iraq, the retreat from such international treaties as the Kyoto Protocol on global warming and the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. The underlying assumption is that, in the end, the U.S. can go it alone because it is simply so powerful. Charles Kupchan says this assumption is woefully off the mark. Kupchan is a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and professor of international relations at Georgetown University. He served as a director for European affairs on the National Security Council during the first Clinton administration. In his new book, The End of the American Era, he argues that the United States is far more vulnerable than it appears, and that the rising challenger to its dominance is the European Union. I asked Charles Kupchan what he thinks of the conventional wisdom that the United States is the world's dominant superpower.
I agree with those who claim that the United States today is still dominant, still in a position of military and economic supremacy. Where I cut against the conventional wisdom is on the durability of American dominance, how long it's going to last. And there I think people are just taking a snapshot of the world today and not looking at deeper trends beneath the surface, such as the rise of an amalgamated Europe that can challenge the United States, and a potential change in American politics away from the activist and robust internationalism of the past 50 years to something that could become more diffident, more difficult, perhaps a turning inward.
So does that mean we're looking at the wrong standards, that we spend more on defense than the world's other major superpowers combined, that our economy is twice the size of Japan's? Those aren't the standards that one should judge our power by?
Well, I think that military power only gets you so much. And the fact that the United States spends more than the rest of the great powers combined on defense does mean that we will remain militarily dominant for decades to come. But I think that most people tend to compare the U.S. to other countries, to Japan, to China, to Germany. And there, the U.S. is miles ahead, and nobody has a chance of catching us anytime soon. But where I think the mistake is in failing to appreciate how revolutionary the process of integration is in Europe, that Europe is going through a process quite similar to the one the United States went through in the 19th century. We started with a constitution, and then we began to knit together our separate states. The Europeans started by taking little steps, knitting together their separate states through a coal and steel community, through a common market. And lo and behold, they now have a single market, a single currency, and there is a constitutional convention underway as we speak. And so I think what's happening is Europe is amassing its capability. It is emerging with a GDP almost equal to that of the United States. It will not challenge us militarily, but it is already becoming a political and a diplomatic counterweight.
Now, you argue that as Europe's power grows, its relationship with the U.S. will become increasingly antagonistic on many levels. And clearly, the Bush administration has alienated European nations with its foreign policy on Iraq and its unilateralism. Is that what you're talking about? Are we headed for a clash on the question of statecraft?
Well, I think there are two different dynamics that are taking place. One of them is simply the balance of power, realpolitik. And that is that as we shift from a world with only one center of power to a world with one and a half or two centers of power, of necessity, a certain amount of competition will kick in. Simply because of human nature, the desire for influence, prestige, primacy. Competition of that sort has been absent from the landscape because no one can come after the United States. There's no challenger. I think that as the EU comes of age, as the EU begins to take a more collective stand on issues, it will of necessity set its weight against the United States, and therefore a certain amount of competition is inevitable. I think the question is, will competition that is healthy turn into competition that is adversarial in nature? And that's where U.S. behavior is so important, because the United States, since the Bush team has come to power, has been quite unilateralist, quite dismissive of the Kyoto Protocol, the International Criminal Court, the EU's desire to begin to assume more responsibility for its own defense. And in that sense, the Bush administration has alienated Europe. I think it speaks volumes that the Chancellor of Germany, a country that has been a close ally of the U.S. for decades, runs for re-election on an anti-American platform and wins. That's just the tip of the iceberg, I think, and the potential for the EU and the United States to part ways in ways that could have major consequences, not just for the Atlantic relationship, but for the global landscape.
What do you think of the Bush administration's pursuit so far of the struggle against terrorism? What's on the mark and what's troubling to you as you look ahead to our position in the world in the future?
I think the Bush administration has done a reasonably good job in the battle against terror if we look at the tactical level. The attack in Afghanistan against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, the effort to cooperate more fully on law enforcement and on tracking funding for terrorist groups. And they're beginning to make necessary changes here at home in terms of homeland security. If one, however, moves to the strategic level, the big picture, I give the Bush administration much lower marks. And that's because I think that for President Bush and those around him, they think that the terror attacks of September 11 have changed the world, that terrorism is the new entity that defines the geopolitical landscape and where fault lines fall on that landscape. And that's why I think you are seeing them pursue the war on terror with such fixation. In my mind, that is a mistake. I think the world has changed less than the Bush team thinks. There is still an agenda out there that has to do with great power cooperation, institutions, the environment, development in the third world that is being neglected. And in that sense, I think the Bush administration has a view of the world that almost no one else shares. And that's one of the reasons that we are seeing the United States find itself in such isolation on the global landscape.
I guess you could argue, though, that this kind of unilateralism is just a trend, a short-term trend, a temporary aberration on the part of the Bush administration.
I don't think it is. There are many debates in Washington and in think tanks and universities around the country on this very question. That is this a passing phenomenon, a blip that will go away once President Bush is out of office and those people around him are no longer in power? I don't share that view. I think that what President Bush represents is a shift, a secular shift in American politics and American demographics that will push the U.S. towards both unilateralist and neo-isolationist impulses as time moves forward. And that is in part because the U.S. has a very long history of being both unilateralist and neo-isolationist. Indeed, from 1781, when we began life as a country, until Pearl Harbor, essentially, we were very diffident about engagement in the world. And when we did engage, we wanted to do it on our own terms. What put us into a centrist course towards institutions, towards permanent alliances, was World War II and the Soviet threat. And I believe that with that threat gone, we will not practice the same form of centrist moderate internationalism. And that's why I think we are seeing the country move toward the extremes of unilateralism for now. But I would not bet that the neo-isolationism that we saw during the first year of the Bush administration prior to September 11, let's keep our powder dry, let's pull out of the Balkans, let's not broker the peace in the Middle East, that's for now silenced, but it is by no means gone in terms of our political culture and our politics.
Many policy analysts see the world dividing along cultural lines into the poor non-Western nations and the West, and that's what we're already seeing in the struggle against terrorism. It's an East-West divide, which is an ideological divide, exacerbated by the growing disparity between richer nations and poorer nations. You disagree?
I do disagree in the sense that I think if you look back historically, there is much more trouble within civilizations than there is between them. There is much more conflict, animosity within the Muslim world than there is between the Muslim world and Judeo-Christian countries. And I think that's partly because countries that live alongside each other that happen to share a common civilization or a common religion or ethnicity often threaten each other. And that strategic issues, borders, access to water, often trumps cultural issues when it comes to geopolitics. And I also think that the extent to which poverty is going to be the breeding ground of the new fault line, that is, angry, super-empowered, angry people will come after the United States, is vastly overblown in the sense that, unfortunately, most of the world that is poor is not of geopolitical consequence. And that's because, let's say, a country like Botswana, with a very high percentage of HIV in its population, may well disappear as a country if we don't do something about it. So I see this as a humanitarian emergency, perhaps of epic proportions, but we should deal with it precisely on those grounds, as a humanitarian emergency, and not see it as a strategic threat. And that's why I think we ought to pay attention to what has always bedeviled diplomacy and statesmen throughout history, and that is competition and rivalry between centers of power.
I'm talking with Charles Kupchan. He's a senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. He teaches international relations at Georgetown University. He served on the National Security Council during the first Clinton administration, and he's the author of a number of books on foreign policy. His new book is The End of the American Era. We're going to take a break now, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Charles Kupchan. He served on the National Security Council during the first Clinton administration. He's now a professor of international relations at Georgetown University, and he has a new book about American foreign policy called The End of the American Era. Are there successes on the part of the EU's economic integration policies that make you think that Europe will surpass the U.S. As a superpower, even though Europe has such a small defense capability?
Well, right now we're at a Europe that has collectively about $8.5 trillion GDP. The United States is around 10 or a little bit past that. If you look at enlargement, you look at the potential for Europe to grow at a pace roughly equal to that of the United States, then you do see the two entities begin to pull even as this decade progresses. And I also think that the EU has certain distance to go in on the economic front, that if it loosens certain regulations, will in fact pick up growth, potentially produce growth that is beyond what the United States is experiencing. In one example would be, for example, the internet penetration rate. A lot of the startup money that was in the U.S. during the dot-com revolution left our shores when the bubble burst, and it's now in Europe. And so it may well be that the internet revolution, the sort that we had in the 90s, comes to Europe in this decade, increasing productivity and efficiency. And we also see a Europe that will, of necessity, begin to cope with some of the constraints on its economic growth, labor immobility, a state that is a little bit too interventionist in the economy. And once those changes go ahead, and yes, they will be slow, they will be difficult to get, but they will be forthcoming, I think you'll see European economic growth pick up.
Let's talk about oil. I think plenty of foreign policy analysts argue that the current administration's policy is driven by the politics of oil, our dependence on oil, and financial interest in controlling oil reserves and the oil markets. You don't spend an inordinate amount of time in your book on the oil factor. Why not?
Well, I think there's no question that oil plays a big role in our foreign policy, that one of the reasons that the U.S. has as many troops in the Persian Gulf as it does is to protect the flow of oil. It's central to the health of the industrialized world. I don't spend a lot of time dealing with it, in part because it is an issue that gets a lot of treatment elsewhere, but also because I think that right now the landscape is one in which access to oil is relatively assured because of our ties with the conservative regimes in the Persian Gulf, because of the gradual diffusion of our sources of supply. And to the extent that I do deal with this issue, I focus more on American consumption, because I think the real culprit here in terms of our dependence on oil is simply the U.S. consumes too much. We have 4% of the world's population, but consume 25% of the annual energy consumption. And in that sense, we are setting ourselves up for trouble. And I think our strategic policy on defending oil is reasonably good. Where we need to spend a lot more time is decreasing domestic consumption and looking for new sources.
You worked in the Clinton White House, and you know how a president interacts with foreign policy advisors. So what are your reactions as you watch how the Bush administration is developing its foreign policy, knowing what it's like to be in the White House and to hash out these decisions?
I find several aspects of the Bush team quite remarkable. The first is its discipline. I have never seen a White House so tight-fisted about information, so able to stay on message day after day, whether it's Rumsfeld speaking or whether it's Wolfowitz speaking or whether it's Condi Rice speaking. They really hum like a well-greased machine in ways that previous administrations did not. The other thing that I think is striking is how little we actually know. The press corps here in Washington complains regularly that no one is really disclosing how things work in the White House. The ambassadors that I communicate with occasionally say they can barely get their foot in the door. And I think that is part of this discipline. It's part of the plan of the Bush administration to keep tight reins, both over the formulation of policy, but also over public diplomacy. And it's clearly paid off. I think the midterm elections and the success of the Republicans were directly related to the message creation. As far as who seems to be running the show, I can only guess because I don't think we have good information yet. But it looks like the central cleavages are between Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz on one side, Secretary of State Powell on the other side, who is more moderate, more committed to institutions. My sense is that Condi Rice is the person who arbitrates, and that the real power behind the scenes is Dick Cheney, the vice president. He seems to have not just the president's ear, but I think a relationship with each of these other players that puts him in a central position.
Do you see George W. Bush's personality or his personal experience actually driving policy? I'm thinking that other than trips maybe to Mexico from Texas, he's a man who had only been out of the country three times before he got to the White House. He has very little international experience.
I think he's a changed man. I think if you go back and watch his behavior and listen to what he said from January 20 to September 11, you saw someone who really was not that interested in an America that was out in all quarters of the globe running the show. He kept referring to an America that could not be everything for everybody. He wanted to focus on the Western Hemisphere. His first two meetings were with Chrétien, head of Canada, and Fox, the head of Mexico. His first state dinner was for Fox. His first summit was a summit of the Americas in Quebec. So the center of his world was North America and the Western Hemisphere. That all came to a screeching halt on September 11. Mexico has essentially been chagrined because they feel Bush has turned his back on them, and now it's terrorism 24/7. Whether Bush and the Republican Party stay that way is a separate matter, but I do think that the president was profoundly changed by those events, and that he continues to keep terrorism as his guiding light, and the basis not just for his foreign policy, but also for his building domestic support across the American public and on Capitol Hill.
You have great respect for the discipline that the Bush administration has been able to maintain, its focus on foreign policy. I gather that wasn't your experience in the Clinton administration?
Well, the Clinton administration was just a little bit more loosey-goosey. People were talking to the press. There were frequent leaks. there were disagreements among players that sort of snuck their way out into the public. And in that sense, I think there was less sort of top-down order. There was less, it was run less like a corporation and more a little bit like kind of a bull session, sitting around in the room and people throwing in their two cents. I am much more sympathetic with the policies that the Clinton administration pursued than I am with the Bush people. But in terms of the actual process, the way it functions on a day-to-day basis, I think the Bush people have put together a very impressive operation.
Charles Kupchan, thanks very much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
Charles Kupchan is the author of The End of the American Era. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.